Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 297, we are back with the Traditional Journal Club. I'm joined by Drs. Avni Finn, Safa Romani, and Yoshi Yonakawa for this journal club, where we cover four recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. First, we discuss DRCRNet's protocols AG and AH, looking at pneumatic vitreolysis for vitreomacular traction with or without macular hole. Next, we move on to a postdoc analysis of protocol AB, looking at comparison of aflibercept versus vitrectomy for proliferative diabetic retinopathy. We then move on to an insurance database claim study looking at the rate of recurrent retinal detachment and reoperation within 90 days of surgery. And we end with a discussion of a postdoc analysis from the PIVOT study looking at OCT photoreceptor integrity in patients receiving pneumatic retinopexy versus vitrectomy. Remember, you can find a list of financial disclosures relevant to this podcast in the episode description. You can also find a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a traditional journal club, and I have the pleasure of being joined by three of my colleagues from around the country. We're going to go in alphabetical order, and ironically, it's going to take us from west to east. So we're going to start on the west coast with Dr. Avni Finn, who's in the Bay Area. Avni, welcome.
Thanks, Jay.
Next, Dr. Safa Romani. She's in Chicago at Northwestern University. Safa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Last but not least, my hero, Dr. Yoshihiro Yonakawa, who's at Wills Eye Mid-Atlantic in Philly. Yoshi, welcome.
Got it. Thank you, Jay. It's an honor to be back.
I'm just glad you corrected me at some point that you don't have a middle initial. That's Y. So I stopped calling you triple Y every time you came on the podcast.
Yeah, Jay somehow thought I had middle initial starts with Y.
I make things up sometimes. Like I was asking you guys about a case that was presented at a meeting today. And now half of me believes I may have just dreamt the whole thing. You know, it's like that deja, you get a feeling of deja vu every once in a while. And speaking of deja vu, we're going to talk about a DRCR paper here. And DRCRNet has branched out. They used to be just the Diabetic Research Clinical or Diabetic Retinopathy Clinical Research Network. Now they do more than that. They've done trials outside of diabetes. And this is one of them. The title of this paper was Pneumatic Vitreolysis with C3F8 for vitreomacular traction with and without macular hole. This is a DRCO protocol AG and AH. Avni, do you want to tell us a little bit about the study and how it was designed and what the results showed?
Sure. So Jay, like you said, you know, this was two studies, AG and AH, that were both looking at the role of pneumatic vitreolysis as potentially a less invasive, lower cost option to treat vitreomacular traction with and without holes. So the first study, AG, was set up as a randomized clinical trial, really having two arms, one comparing pneumatic vitreolysis to sham injection for vitreomacular traction without the presence of the full thickness macular hole. And then the second study was actually a single arm study just evaluating pneumatic vitreolysis for the setting of VMT with a full thickness macular hole. In both studies, they performed a pneumatic vitreolysis as an intravitreal injection of 0.3 cc's of 100% C3F8 gas. And it's really important, the authors note this as well, to note that both studies were terminated early due to safety concerns because of a high rate of retinal tear and detachment. So I'll just go into a little bit of how the studies were set up. The inclusion criteria for protocol AG, which was the VMT study without macular hole, was having an area of adhesion of 3000 microns or less, no lamellar or macular hole, and the visual acuity range could be anywhere from 2032 to 2400 in that study. Primarily, they were interested in looking at central VMT release by 24 weeks without vitrectomy. And then they had a bunch of secondary outcomes that they looked at, the time it took to release, the proportion needing vitrectomy, change in vision, and then gain or loss of 10 letters of vision. And I'll go into some of the results in brief. But basically, before the study terminated, they enrolled 46 eyes. 24 of those eyes got pneumatic vitreolysis, and 22 had the sham injection. By 24 weeks of follow-up, there were 78% of eyes who received pneumatic vitreolysis who had VMT release without vitrectomy, and only 9% of the sham eyes had VMT release at that point. Two of the eyes in the pneumatic vitreolysis group in this arm of the study needed a vitrectomy after the VMT event in order to treat retinal detachments. And then looking at some of their outcomes, their secondary outcomes, so visual acuity, there was no statistically significant difference between the two groups. They did look at some exploratory outcomes, which I think in general were sort of better outcomes to look at for this disease entity. Loss of ellipsoid zone integrity happened in about 27% of the pneumatic vitreolysis group and a greater percent, 50% in the sham group. There was interestingly no difference between the two groups in what they used, I think, as sort of a measure of metamorphopsia, but it was a technology called My Vision Track, which helped look at the difference in shape discrimination between the two groups. And there actually was no significant difference in the pneumatic vitreolysis and sham groups in looking at that. So protocol AH, which was the part of the study looking at vitreomacular traction with concurrent full thickness macular hole, also had very similar inclusion criteria in that the area of the length of the adhesion had to be 3000 microns or less. The visual acuity range was 2025 to 2400 in this part of the study. And then in addition to getting the intravitreal injection of C3F8 gas, the patients in this study had to do 50% face down positioning for 4 days after the injection. Surgeons were allowed to do a rescue vitrectomy in these patients between 4 to 8 weeks if the macular hole size did not improve or at their discretion. And the primary outcome here was macular hole closure with inner retinal layer closure. And then they also had some secondary outcomes like time to macular hole closure, central VMT release, eyes needing vitrectomy, and then gain or loss of 10 or more letters. They were able to enroll 35 participants in this study before the early termination. And 29%, so only 10 of 35 eyes had mac hole closure with pneumatic vitreolysis, 4 of those at 8 weeks and 6 at 24 weeks. There were notably a lot of vitrectomies done in this study. So rescue vitrectomy was performed in 23 eyes in total. There were 20 eyes that underwent procedures for macular hole, and then 5 procedures in 4 eyes for retinal detachment repair. And at 24 weeks, 18 eyes gained 10 or more letters and 3 eyes lost 10 or more letters. It's important, I think, in both of these studies to note the safety findings because that was the reason for early termination. So 7 of the total 59 eyes enrolled in both AG and AH had retinal tears or detachments. So there were 6 detachments and 1 tear. 2 happened in protocol AG and then 5 in AH with the macular holes. All of those eyes were treated with vitrectomy. There were no retinal tears or detachment in the sham group. And then 1 eye actually needed a cataract surgery for a traumatic cataract that happened during a pre-injection paracentesis as well. So I think some of the big conclusions from this study are that, you know, the study did show that pneumatic vitreolysis did effectively result in VMT release in 78% of eyes in protocol AH, but it was really much less effective in closing macular holes and had this high rate of complications. There was no difference in improved visual acuity in the sham groups, kind of in favor of the natural history of VMT release when you don't have a mac hole present. And I think that compared to the high success rate with vitrectomy, which is 80 to 100%, depending in the hands of the surgeon, the 29% rate of MAC hole closure was disappointing in protocol AAH. There are several notable limitations to the study. You know, I think for any surgical study, even though they did have a randomized trial for AG, you can't really control for a lot of surgeon factors, the way in which they inject the gas, whether you obtain fish eggs, which, you know, potentially may have resulted in some of these complications or precipitated complications, we don't really know. And then there are patient factors in terms of the positioning for the macular hole and how much positioning was done. And then lastly, one, the important limitations noted by the authors are the small sample size because of the early termination and the limited follow-up to 24 weeks.
It's a good, really great summary of a lot of data and a lot of stuff to unpack. I've got like a bunch of thoughts jotted down in my brain because I didn't take paper with me, but I think, Yoshi, I'm gonna let you go first. I think the first thing I always look at is study design, right? And how you recruit these patients. And I have to say, this is a tough condition to recruit for generally, because VMT is common, but it's not as common as some of the other things that are studied in clinical trials, at least clinically significant and visually significant VMT, when you compare it to something like diabetic retinopathy or macular degeneration or DME. A lot easier to recruit big numbers. It's a lot harder to recruit numbers here. But one of the things I think about is, like, from an ethical standpoint, they had to stop the study because of these complications. But Omni said there was no difference. We know that a lot of VMT resolves on its own. I'm always curious in the design why they didn't, it didn't seem like they built in a period of observation, right? Like almost like a quote unquote, not really a washout period because there's no medication, but like you had to have had VMT diagnosed and had it present for X amount of time. And it was persistent before you were enrolled in the trial. This was seemed to be like, you have VMT, you're symptomatic, you can get enrolled. And maybe they don't hit their numbers if they don't do that. But that makes the detachments and the tears almost sadder in a way, because many of these patients may have spontaneously resolved anyway. Now, we know the release rate was much higher in the treatment group than the control group here. But I always think about that when I see a trial that's suspended due to complications, is, man, I really feel badly for any patient who may have had a complication who maybe never needed to have any intervention in the first place.
Yeah, great, great points, Jay. I think this is something that I was always intrigued by. And the, you know, every time you have something that's less invasive and you can treat something that way, it's great. And I think patients will like that idea. So I'm not sure if it was the hardest thing to recruit for, because I'm sure a lot of patients, you know, like the sound of, hey, we can fix this potentially without surgery. And Clement Chang, who's the first author of this paper, super duper smart guy. And he did his own study initially looking at this. And I remember when he presented the data at one of the meetings with great outcomes, I was really intrigued. And the Santa Barbara group also did their study also. So, but I personally, in response to your other question about, you know, specific patient selections and, you know, what about those that just pop off on their own, I personally never came across the perfect patient. And it had to be really perfect for me personally, because I was worried about detachments and efficacy too. And for me, and still is, it would be somebody with a very focal symptomatic VMT that we've observed for a while that's not improving or worsening with observation, with no peripheral lesions like lattice or high risk factors like high myopia, and someone who's a poor anesthesia candidate. But the study clearly shows that pneumatic vitreolysis works. So for people who are poor surgical candidates who know these risks, I think it's an option, but it's not going to be the majority of patients by any means. And our gold standard, I think, is going to continue to be vitrectomy. I mean, 12% RDRT retinal tear rate is too high for me personally. But if, you know, you have an option. And the other thing that Avni also alluded to, the study was cut short. It's only about, it was only through halfway of recruitment. And so the data are data, but we don't know what the complete picture would have been if you went to the study completion.
Yeah, and Safa, these are patients that I think we've all been taught based on older data on, for example, the tear rate when you do a vitrectomy for macular hole and some of the new iris data. And I just remember anecdotally, some of my attendings and fellows were talking about how patients who have vitreo retinal adhesion abnormalities, macular holes, VMTs, they have, many of these patients have a quote unquote abnormal vitreous, and that vitreo retinal interface is abnormal, maybe more prone to tears. Now, the tear and detachment rate was 12%. When you're inducing a PVD, we know in the general population, if someone walks them with the PVD, the tear rate is between 5 to 10% of an exam, depending on the study you look at. So like, this may be not so out of line, but my two questions to you would be, you know, Yoshi talked about that perfect patient. For me, it's also about access. It's like, I know that I'm inducing a PVD. I need somebody who A, is not going to freak out because they get flashes and floaters, because we know that's going to happen. B, is still going to come in and get checked if they have that. And C, going to have access to keep getting checked, because we know that PVDs are a dynamic process. And now you're quote unquote accelerating perhaps a dynamic process with an expansile bubble. And that feeds into my second question, which is, what about the gas selection here, right? So C3, so I think advocates for this, many people who do pneumatics, for example, we'll talk about pneumatics a little later, they advocate for SF6 over C3F8 because they feel like expands less. You're less likely to quote stretch the vitreous, maybe get breaks, and maybe it's a slower sort of release. Any thoughts on either of these points or anything else from this paper?
No, I think you brought up great points. The peripheral exam and really these patients having abnormal, you know, retinal vitreous connections is really key. You know, the study really didn't focus on what was the percentage of any abnormalities that they saw peripherally. And I know when, you know, during surgeries, when we pop these PVDs, I am watching the PVD and watching the peripheral retina like a hawk. And in the majority of cases, you know, things pop, you know, they can cause little tears here and there, there are adhesions. So to really, you know, focus on what was going on in the periphery that could potentially cause these issues with, as you mentioned, the more expansile gases, I think really brings it a point as to why there was such a potentially a high failure rate. And I agree with Ryoshi. I mean, it sounds great because anything that's less invasive that gives you almost as good of an outcome, you know, I think patients would be up for. But in this case, I think there was just too much that couldn't be controlled for or looked at, so.
And Avni, to the point about the peripheral exam, it's interesting that of the 7 tear/detachments, 6 were already detached when they were diagnosed. So it seems that either there's something lacking, or you would assume that these patients were educated, and these are trial patients. So trial patients tend to be more motivated, more hooked in, that even in a quote unquote more maybe educated, responsible population with people checking on them, this is the problem with tears that you're inducing potentially, is that they may not arrive in time to avoid being diagnosed with a detachment and needing some sort of detachment repair versus a tear, which could be really simple with laser.
I thought that was interesting too, because most of them were detachments and only one was a tear. And the other thing I thought was interesting was actually the follow-up interval, because they saw the patients pretty spaced out, like it was 1 week and then 4 weeks. And in my experience, if that vitreoretinal interface is going to change, it changes pretty quickly and the VMT releases pretty quickly. Like, you know, I think when the Santa Barbara group did their study, they reported most of the change was within the 24 to 48 hour period. And so it might have been helpful to have closer follow-up for these patients, especially if you're worried about the abnormal vitreous and potentially inducing a tear, and you want to check the peripheral retina every single time to make sure nothing has developed.
And so I think I have kind of two other thoughts. So for first thought, we never really talk about this, but one of my mentors brought this up to me when they heard this paper, they saw the paper came out. They were critical and they said, I don't understand why a paper that was suspended early from a trial is being published in such a quote unquote prestigious journal in our field. But I would take the opposite point, Yoshi. I actually think this is super valuable. We should publish negative results more often. It would actually be very helpful, because I'll tell you, this was never that much in my wheelhouse. I can give you an anecdotal story in a second of the one time I did this and how that went. But this is helpful. I think this is really helpful to know, because it doesn't mean that this is wrong, because we talked about maybe gas selection, peripheral exam, frequency exam, there may be other things you can do, but it does show that unless you're really in that perfect wheelhouse, you gotta be very, very cautious with putting gas in an eye with an attached vitreous and potentially an abnormal vitreoretinal interface.
I agree. I think personally, this is one of the most important papers of the year. And because it's going to change practice patterns, people are not going to be doing this. And so this is a very valuable paper.
And then Safa, so my final thought, which is a silly thought, but you guys are going to laugh. So I was thinking, like, if I was Tom Hanks in Castaway, but I was also a retinal surgeon, and all I had with me was Wilson, and he was monocular, and he had a macular hole with VMT, I don't have my vitrector. Am I going to, but I have acroplasmin and I have gas. And I have a laser. Am I going to A, observe him for the natural history of that mac hole and just be like, you know, Wilson, we had a good run. Am I use acroplasmin or are I going to use this? It's a joke question, but what I'm going to, the reason I thought of this, if you go back to the original Jetria trial, maybe trust, the whole closure rate was better than in this trial. Now, comparing apples to oranges, different trials, different patient populations, but the whole closure rate here was 29%. And in MiviTrust, correct me if I'm wrong, Yoshi, Avni, Safa, I think it was 40%. I think it was 35 to 40% for small hole closure rate. It was in that range. So it was technically a little bit better. So my point is acroplasmin has pretty much been dead in our field. Yoshi just said, you know, this is going to dissuade people from doing this. But if you really had to pick between the two of them, I don't know which one I would pick. I might just observe because I'm just thinking maybe sometimes not better. Maybe I put them on ketorolac and just hope that it goes away. I don't know. What are your thoughts? I mean, if you really had to avoid surgery in someone with a macular hole, what would be your go-to if it's small?
I want to do ketorolac and Predforte, you know, see if it works. I think that's a tough, you know, if you're really thinking about it, that's a tough choice. And if you have no option for surgery, I may go for acroplasmin for Jetria just because at least even if it doesn't work, I'm not as concerned about causing much more significant secondary issues, but
except for unexpected, if unexplained,
loss.
That's small, right? So that's why it's interesting. And then I'll end, you know, my anecdotal story, which ties into VBS, ironically, the Buccal Society, is the only time I did this, I had a patient show up in my clinic with like a 16 papers and like a chart. She was a PhD, very nice patient with vitreo macular traction, macular hole. And she had that Clement Chan paper and she had pulled book chapters on it. And she was like, I've looked at all the options and I want this one. Like she was very, very educated. And I was like, okay. I was like a year or two out. And I was like, you know what? Let's do it. And I did it, but I did it 2 days before I flew out to VBS in Las Vegas. And my advice to you is don't do it right before you go to a meeting, because I remember being on the plane waiting to take off. And she started calling me saying she was seeing flashes and floaters, which is to be expected, right? This the timeline where you expect it. And she was freaking out. And then, you know, I had to coordinate on the tarmac, like to get someone to see her. And I was just like, after that, I was like, it's kind of like a pneumatic, which we'll talk about later. I was like, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I got to have like a follow-up plan, like set up in advance. Like I need to have a way to see you day two, day seven, day 10. I'm not going to do this right before I go to a meeting. So that was a rookie move. And any other thoughts on this paper before we move on to the next one? All right. So next paper, we're going to stick with DRCR. Yoshi's going to tell us about this one. So we talked in one of our previous journal clubs about protocol. I think this is protocol AB, which is vitrectomy versus aflibercept for vitreous hemorrhage. This is looking at the secondary outcomes that were published. Yoshi, ironically, I think you may have been on that podcast. We reviewed that one too. Although I might just be going crazy with my deja vu today.
I feel the same way.
It wasn't you. It felt like you were there, and it's going to feel even more like you were there after you finished telling us about this paper. I'm pretty sure you were there. We'd have to go back.
We talked about this paper before.
Yeah. It's been a long time. It's been a long run. So this is visual acuity, vitreous hemorrhage, and other ocular outcomes after vitrectomy versus aflibercept for vitreous hemorrhage due to diabetic retinopathy, a secondary analysis of a randomized clinical trial by Glassman et al. In JAMA ophthalmology. Yoshi, tell us, what did they look at and what did they show?
All right. So protocol AB, the primary endpoint was at 6 months. And essentially, in the first paper, they showed that visual acuity was the same eventually, whether you got injections versus had vitrectomy. And the vitrectomy group regained vision much quicker at about 4 weeks. And about a third of injection patients ended up needing vitrectomy. And about a third of the vitrectomy patients ended up needing injections. And so this is a follow-up paper to that that provides more granular data. And also looking at two-year data so that we can really kind of fine-tune our understanding. And because this paper is really important, it's going to affect practice patterns also. And they looked at different subgroups. So the new analysis here, looking at the post-hoc subgroups. First, they looked at different vision groups presenting visual acuities, relatively good, medium, and really poor. They also looked at what gave you vision 20/25 or better, how long did it take the hem to clear, what about resolution of NV and need for cataract surgery. They also looked at whether the eyes crunched or not. So all very interesting topics. And so here are the results. When baseline visual acuity was poor, so basically worse than 2800, the mean visual acuity over the course of the 24 weeks, that was the area under the curve, vitrectomy was better. So to repeat this important finding, if the patient basically can't read the chart, vitrectomy will result in better vision. But if they see better than that 2800 or better, there was no difference. And this was strongly driven by how much better the vision was at the 1 month visit. And in fact, if you look at the figures, looking at the graphs, the injection arms do catch up at 3 months, even in the really bad vision group. But it just speaks to how much quicker your vision will improve and that delta if your vision starts off really bad. Now, the second main outcome was how long did it take for the vitreous hemorrhage to clear? Vitrectomy, it was 1 month. Injections, it took 9 months. And so this is really critical information also, that in the injection arm, about half of the patients still had vitreous hemorrhage at the end of 2 years. Now, this was any vitreous hemorrhage, so it may not be affecting vision. But for vitrectomy, at the end of 2 years, it was essentially nobody with vitreous hemorrhage anymore. And along similar lines, another interesting analysis was looking at recurrent vitreous hemorrhage once the initial vitreous hemorrhage cleared. And so about half of the patients in the injection arm had recurrent vitreous hemorrhages, but only 17% in the vitrectomy arm. So if you had a vit, chances were less likely that you would have recurrent hemorrhage. And another endpoint, the probability of achieving really good vision, 20/25 or better. And patients ask this all the time, will my vision be normal? And so at 1 month, vitrectomy had better vision, more likelihood of having 20/25 or better. At 2 years is pretty equivalent. Now, what about the crunch question? This is something we debate all the time. They didn't look at this directly because, you know, you have an eye filled with blood, you can't really see too well, but they looked at whether patients had a TRD, also looking at when the injection took place, whether it was 6 days or fewer, was it 1 week or more before, or what if you had no injection? And there was no real difference there. What about time to resolution of the neovascularization? Another interesting kind of topic we're talking about in PDR these days. Vitrectomy did really well. The resolution of the NV took place at the 1 month mark. Injections took about 3 months. And so I think those were the kind of interesting points from the paper. And to conclude, just to summarize, the advantages of vitrectomy, it's faster clearance, you have lower recurrence rates, and you can avoid injections in about 2/3 of patients. And advantage of injections, you can avoid surgery in 2/3 of patients. And from 3 months and on, your vision's going to be similar all the way to 2 years.
Great, great summary. And a really, again, impactful paper. Limitations, obviously, is a post-hoc analysis of a randomized controlled trial. So this was not what initially was being looked at as primary outcomes. But I think it's actually, post-hoc analyses can be really, really helpful and have defined a lot of things that we do. Safa, I guess my question, for everything Yoshi said there as a summary, does any of that surprise you or corroborate what you already feel about vitrectomy and anti-VEGF for vitreous hemorrhage in diabetics?
I think none of it really surprised me. I think it kind of corroborates what I see clinically, similar to, you know, anti-VEGF versus PRP. You know, the vitrectomy is much more definitive and quicker, but for the right patients who really, you know, are good with follow-up and good about coming in and motivated not to have surgery, I think injections can be a really good option. So I really think it's, you know, it gives more options for us as clinicians to really choose, you know, the path that works best for the patient. Because if you have a clinical course that does not match what the patient can do, the patient just can't follow up like, you know, you want them to, or variety of other reasons. I feel like if you can tailor your treatment to what the patient needs, I think you'll just have much better outcomes.
Yeah, those are good points. And Avni, my question that I asked, I think Yoshi in that other podcast that I thought we did, but maybe we did it only in my dreams. So my question is, what do you do now? So a diabetic shows up with count fingers, vitreous hemorrhage to your clinic and they're phakic. Are you injecting them? Are you taking them to surgery? Assuming the B scan shows no detachment, assuming there's not a pressing need for vision, there are other ICs well. How many injections, let's say you start with injections, how many do you do before you go to surgery? Has this altered kind of your paradigm about maybe going to surgery sooner? Or are you still kind of like, okay, I'm going to inject X amount of times and then go?
So I think it does alter my paradigm in a way, because it gives me some evidence to point to the patient that, you know, because the vision is worse, we might do better long-term or be able to help them quicker with a vitrectomy earlier in that patient. And because there was some evidence in this study that if you had worse vision to start with, you could do better long-term compared with aflibercept and having poorer vision to begin with. So I think it doesn't take away any options of being more conservative and, you know, doing injections in this patient, but it does give you some evidence to point to that maybe earlier vitrectomy when vision is worse is better for visual outcomes in patients. You know, we know that earlier vitrectomy helps remove that scaffold for neovascularization. And that's one argument towards ending, resolving the neovascularization earlier. The other thing that was helpful for me to see in the study was the cataract rate wasn't really different between the two groups. So at 2 years, the aflibercept group and the vitrectomy group had similar rates of cataract. And that's always something I worry about in taking a patient earlier to vitrectomy, because these patients tend to be younger, tend to be phakic. And that sort of, at least put my mind to ease about the risk of cataract formation in those patients.
Yeah, that's a great point about the cataract part. That's the one thing from the paper that did surprise me a little bit. Yoshi, any comments on that or other thoughts on this paper?
You know, two other things that I look for clinically in patients with vitreous hemorrhage that the study didn't consider. One was the chronicity of the hemorrhage. So if it's a fresh hemorrhage, I'm probably going to watch. But if a patient comes in with dehemoglobinized vitreous hemorrhage, hand motions, vision, and they're like, doc, it's been like this for 6 months, I'm probably going to be more likely to do surgery. The other common clinical scenario is when diabetic patients develop a PVD. Even if they don't have active PDR, even if it's just NPDR, they're more likely to have vitreous hemorrhage, and you're not going to want to do injections for that.
Great points. And I think those ochre or old hemorrhages, we all done those surgically. Those, you go in and as you're eating it, you're like, this has been here for months to years. This never would have cleared. And it's not really a VEGF mediated process maybe at that point, but more just that the blood gets kind of coagulated and stuck. So let's move on to this next paper, which is need for retinal detachment reoperation based on primary repair method among commercially insured patients. This is by the group out of Stanford, and this is over a 14-year period. Mary Grace Reeves, who was a good stellar ophthalmology candidate this year, I think she matched at WashU, wrote this paper with Armin Afshar and Suzanne Pershing as the senior author. Safa, you want to tell us a little bit about this paper and what they showed?
Yes. So this was a paper with a retrospective cohort study that really looked at the type of primary repair and compared that to what was the rate of retinal detachment in a 90-day period. So what they did is they looked at this administrative claims in a 14-year span between 2003 and 2016 in a clinic informatics DataMart database, which basically included Medicare Advantage and commercial healthcare insurance enrollees. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. And basically looked at a variety of aspects of what these patients have. So basically what their goal was to show a head-to-head real-world data on the likelihood of needing a repair based on the primary method that they chose. So they looked at four ways. So they looked at parsimony vitrectomy, scleral buckle, pneumatic retinopexy, and laser barricade. So those were the four methods that they looked at with CPT codes to try and parse everything out. They did focus on patients that had at least 3 years of continuous health enrollment, and they excluded patients that had confounding ocular comorbidities, so such as tractional or serous detachment, retinoschisis, various retinopathies. So they really tried to focus on primary retinal, degenerative retinal detachments, and see if they can find what these show based on the reoperation rate at 90 days. So, and they used multivariable logistic regression models to really study this. And again, the outcome interest was these four groups. So in terms of demographics, they had about 16,190 patients that they documented with primary, with retinitis retinal repair, and about 18% of those, so about almost 3,000 patients required reoperation within 90 days. And what they found was basically the pseudophakic patients and diabetics were disproportionately represented in terms of patients that needed to get secondary repair. So there are four sort of ways that they, associations that they looked at. First, they looked at the association of primary repair method with the need for a reoperation. So the highest frequency for needing a secondary procedure was observed in patients who went through pneumatic retinopexy at almost 30%. Sclerobuckle and vitrectomy were similar to each other, about 19 to 17%. And then the lowest was actually laser retinopexy. So that was, and then they looked at patients' association of patient characteristics and then the need for reoperation. So male patients had a higher odds ratio for needing secondary repair. Interestingly, the age group bracket 20 to 29 years had the lowest odds ratio, and then the highest was between 30 and 39 years. Again, as mentioned, pseudophakia, vitreous hemorrhage were associated with increased odds of secondary repair, as well as a moderate and severe Charlson comorbidity index, which is basically indication of the sicker patients. There was no trend in geography in terms of anywhere in the US. And the third part that they looked at was, again, the association of the primary repair method with the type of secondary repair. So what they noticed that the patients that had primary pneumatic retinopexy had the highest odds of secondary repair, which was either vitrectomy or sclerobuckle. And then the highest odds for secondary pneumatic procedure was again, was vitrectomy. The second most frequent was sclerobuckle. And again, those were listed in terms of needing at least almost 19% repair. The fourth aspect that they looked at was the association of patient characteristics with the type of secondary repair. And we mentioned a little bit, it was again, strong age-related trend to using secondary repair procedures. And a couple of things that they noticed was myopia, although was associated with significantly higher odds, lattice degeneration was actually associated with significantly lower odds of needing secondary procedures. So that was their finding. So basically what they discussed was, you know, in this cohort of 16,000 patients, and we can talk about, you know, where this cohort came from, because I think that kind of points to their limitation, was that between this 14 years, at least almost about 18% of the patients needed reoperation, with vitrectomy as being the most frequent secondary procedure, regardless of what the primary procedure was. And the reoperation was most likely in males among the patients that are pseudophakic, have vitreous hemorrhage, and are generally unhealthier, have worse systemic outcomes. So a couple of things that I think they really tried to suggest that this is a real world data. You know, it's not looking into visual acuity, it's not looking at the details, and they really tried to focus on, you know, what is being used in this database. So there are quite a few, you know, I think limitations to this study. And this is administrative claims. There's this data does not capture any clinical metrics in terms of the visual acuity, what was the severity of the detachment, and potentially inaccuracies. And then for the vitrectomy, when they looked at it, the secondary vitrectomies that were included, it does not include sclerobuckle because the CPT code includes a PPV with a sclerobuckle. So they couldn't look at that. And again, they said that this is, you know, this is a big cohort that we're looking at, but it's hard to generalize this to sort of changing practice patterns because this was an employee-sponsored and Medicare Advantage insurance. It's not looking into patients with no insurance. It's not looking into and insurances that have less comprehensive coverage, such as like Medicaid, didn't look any of that, which again, those are the patients that face additional barriers to care and disparities that exist, you know, within that group. So it is the, you know, the analysis, you know, was valuable in presenting real world population level findings in terms of primary repair. But I think there's a lot of points that can sort of be brought up in terms of discussions, in terms of what they found in this paper.
Great summary. And that's the biggest reason I thought I told you guys before we recorded that I wanted to talk about this. I think all those limitations are valid. And I think the biggest limitation, besides not capturing the full population of patients because it's limited to an insurance claims database, is you are not separating out vitrectomy with or without a buckle based on codes. All of this is based on codes, right? So why they have the different groups is completely defined. There's different codes for each of these: pneumatic retinopexy, laser for RD, buckle, and vitrectomy plus or minus a buckle. And then they didn't, you know, bring in the complex as much here for primary repair. But this is how these sort of studies are usually separated. The way they define their groups is already predefined by the codes that are available with CPT. So I jotted some notes, and I think there's a couple things to discuss here. Let's start with just this, Avni. Pneumatic retinopexy is a hot topic, I think, always, because people argue about what is the true success rate for pneumatic retinopexy. This is just one snapshot, but we've seen data in the literature that ranges by a huge range, right? Like, we can hear some studies are like 85% and up. Other studies are in the 60s or the 70s. I mean, those are big, big differences. And this goes back to the point we made earlier about the first study, is we want data that's going to help us make decisions when we see a patient. What am I going to do and how am I going to counsel them? And obviously we should each have our own personal rate eventually. If you log enough cases saying, hey, my personal rate of reattachment is blah, blah, blah with this, but big data is still sort of useful to have a data point. So this is 28.7% needed some sort of other procedure. Now you can tease out the ones who just need a gas reinjection, but I still think of that as a second procedure. A patient's probably going to tell another retina specialist one day that they had two surgeries, not one, because they kind of lump all those procedures together. Does that rate surprise you? That seems, for me at least, about where I would anticipate real world outcomes would be, was somewhere in that 25 to 30% fail rate. But what are your thoughts on that number?
That rate doesn't surprise me for pneumatic retinopexy. I think the rates in a randomized clinical trial like the PIVOT study, where the rates are much higher in terms of success for pneumatic retinopexy, those surprised me more, whereas a higher rate of needing a reoperation with pneumatic retinopexy, taking all comers who all potential detachments that are being seen, all potential surgeons that are of varying different levels and experience with the procedure, doing the procedure, I think that's a much more realistic rate of reoperation with the procedure. But that being said, I also thought that the reoperation rate overall for retinal detachments in this study, which was 1 in 5 for any procedure, was also really high compared to what I would think.
There's no hiding from an insurance claims database, right? You know, like, because I don't think you ever meet a retina specialist who says that their rate of reoperation is 20% at 90 days.
Yeah.
Right. That's the thing. And I'm not criticizing anyone. I'm sure we all overestimate, unless you sit there and meticulously log your cases. And we all may overestimate our rate, but I feel like everyone you talk to is always like 95%, 90%, 95%. And then at some point you see a study like this and you're like, well, where's the other percentages that make up this 20%? But this is not unusual if you look at other papers with real world data, like IRIS studies.
Right. And I think that part of it from this study that's difficult to tell is that you're not really able to parse out the procedures corresponding to those reoperation rates as well. And that's where, you know, I think that one of the weaknesses of this study lies, right? You're not really able to parse out that 1 in 5 reoperation rate. You're kind of bundling all the vitrectomies and all the buccal vits together. You're bundling all of the complex and non-complex retinal detachments together. We can't really tell if there was PVR, although we could tell that having vitreous hemorrhage led to a higher rate of needing a reoperation. But there's just a lot of things you really can't parse out in what's going on in that 1 in 5 reoperation rate with this study.
And Yoshi, I mean, you're a big buckler. You do a lot of pediatric retina cases. This is one of the first studies I've seen that says, not first, but compared to pro, we've talked about the pro study a lot. The buckle rate here, the fail rate, quote unquote, for buckles was similar to vitrectomy, which is vitrectomy plus or minus a buckle, right? We don't know how many of those were buckle vits versus vits. That surprised me a little bit, but I almost attribute it to noise, a little bit of junk slash noise here with the data. Like, I just don't know if there's enough to really read into it, but I think it's kind of interesting to look at because usually you don't see that kind of matching up that way.
Yeah, I agree. Retinal detachments are incredibly difficult to study. And each patient is so unique. And if you wanted accurate data points, there would be like 500 different data points per patient that you need to really, you know, log to really understand that eye. And in studies where everything is based on ICD-9 and 10 codes and CPT codes, you're never going to have that granularity. And like you mentioned, it's huge. A buckle versus buckle vit. A primary vitrectomy is buckle vit. It's a huge difference, as we've shown in like almost every single pro paper that we've done. And I think this paper does a great job in painting broad strokes of, you know, just kind of showing what the national trends are. And the fact that, you know, this paper shows 1 in 5 will re-detach, that's probably the most powerful thing about the paper. But looking at the individual risk factors, that's a lot more challenging.
Let's talk about one specific risk factor, Safa, which had that men, it seems, in every RD paper do worse, and there's many potential reasons for that. They brought on one of my favorite pet reasons, which I can never prove, but I just remember, unrelated to surgery, the late Paul Tornabe going up in front of a meeting time at pneumatic retinopexy and listing relative contraindications and adding in bold at the bottom, a man without a female partner or an unmarried man or a widowed man is a risk factor, where he's like, you know what, I may not do a pneumatic because they're probably not going to be compliant with positioning. I always thought that was a little bit sexist against men, but unfortunately, it's sometimes true where there may be a compliance difference. Now, we don't know why the fail rate here is higher in men. There are other hormonal reasons that have been proposed, PVR reasons, et cetera. But I also think that's interesting because that it backs up sort of the things we've observed. I remember in fellowship and even now, that sometimes I do find that some of the highest risk patients for reoperation are, you know, middle-aged men to younger men. And that was kind of that age group plus the gender thing we saw here. Any thoughts on gender differences? And does that ever influence your choice of surgery if you have a man and a woman with otherwise kind of equal pathology?
No, I think those are great points. In my practice, I do think that men tend to run into trouble more just because I think they take more risks, especially the younger men. You know, I have, for every trauma, you know, eye that comes in with a hyphema and a vitreous hemorrhage, 9 out of 10 is going to be men at least in my practice. You know, they're just willing to take more risks and willing to, you know, sort of put themselves out there for whatever reason and can get into trouble more. And I do agree with, especially with middle-aged men. I mean, most of my patients come in, you know, their wives are really telling them what to do and really keeping up with, you know, all the directions. And, you know, I think it makes a huge difference. Whereas females are, I don't know, inherent or not, or societal or not, tend to try to follow the rules and what we tell them much more closely than men do. I've definitely noticed that in my practice.
Well, let's pivot because I need to go out and ride my motorcycle without a helmet as a young man. Yoshi, you had one other thought about risky activities that you and I partake in.
Yeah, you know, while Safa was, talking here, I looked up my case log of all the patients who re-detached, and I didn't believe it until we talked about it tonight, but the majority are men.
I actually have looked at that myself in my own case logs, and I think it's like a 2-to-1 ratio. And I take that as a failure on my part in a way, because that means there's something we're missing there. Like there, I'm going to say something controversial, but maybe not. I think there is a quote unquote accepted rate of re-detachment, but I don't think we should ever accept that. I don't think that you can ever just say that that's okay. I don't know. I think it's hard because I think if you, if you attribute every detachment thing you could have done, you're never going to actually hit 100%. It's hard to be perfect, but I think we should always strive for it. I need to do a better job taking care of my men. And Yoshi, you should too. Pointing and wagging my finger at you. Shame on you. So let's pivot off that awkward subject to our last study, which is the pivot study, or at least a postdoc analysis. And there's been a lot of postdoc analyses from the pivot study. They sort of blend together, but this one's about postoperative photoreceptor integrity following pneumatic retinopexy versus pars plana vitrectomy for retinal detachment repair. I don't know if you guys noticed in the PDF I sent you, is they said pneumatic retinopathy. In the title, there was a typo. And hopefully when this gets to print or when they adjust this, this is what happens in the era where we're producing these papers so rapidly, is sometimes the proofs go out before the authors have a chance to review it, because I'm sure the authors would have caught that. But we're talking about pneumatic retinopexy, not retinopathy. And so this looked at essentially OCT findings in these two groups. We referenced, Safa referenced the pivot study earlier, or I think Avni as well, like this head-to-head pneumatic retinopexy versus vitrectomy. And they've done all these sub analyses. So this one looked at the OCT findings in terms of discontinuity of ellipsoid zone and the ELM. And both of these have been described in previous papers as being really important OCT biomarkers for visual outcome and visual recovery after retinal detachment repair, especially macula involving retinal detachment repair. And I think the biggest takeaway was the summary is if you look at 12 months after these procedures, there's more discontinuity of both the ELM and the ellipsoid zone in the vitrectomy group than the pneumatic retinopexy group. And that may explain what some studies have shown, including PIVOT, that the visual outcomes tend to trend better in the pneumatic retinopexy groups in these head-to-head studies. So I'm going to work backwards and start with Safa here. What do you make of this, right? So like, I think that Yoshi referenced that retinal detachment studies are already really, really challenging, but one of the ways you can overcome that challenge is by doing a prospective study and collecting data. Now, this is a post-hoc analysis. They were not looking at this as a primary measure. That being said, they did have this data available and they went back. Grading ellipsoid discontinuity in ELM, there are limitations to how you grade that. This is not some sort of really, really highly standardized grading system. There are limitations. They are using masked graders, but there's still, this is not at the same level as a computer algorithm or some sort of artificial intelligence analyzing. This is your human beings analyzing them. And their argument is that this is only two kind of found findings, and there are probably other findings in OCT that could be quantified beside these two. So what do you make of this, Safa? Does this make you more inclined to do pneumatic, or now are you just uber confused because we just talked about how the fail rate was higher than we thought, and now we have this data saying that maybe we should be doing pneumatics, or at least the visual outcomes are better potentially in pneumatics due to OCT findings?
You know, I think this brings up a good point, because one of my mentors at Mass Eye and Ear always say that surgery is iatrogenic trauma, you know, and even though we think that we're doing, good with our surgeries and the visual outcomes are, you know, better than leaving them alone, we are still, you know, there's still a lot of dynamics in surgery, especially, you know, eye pressures, patients, you know, blood pressure, those kind of things that we don't really have perfect control over in terms of how each patient responds. And I can easily see, as they're looking at this easy layer, that the patients that have a little bit of a systemic risk factors, just having the same eye pressure while we're doing surgery may not, the eye may not be able to take that kind of pressure compared to the next patient. So when we do these detailed studies, I think those are kind of things that kind of bring into view that, you know, even as Yoshi has mentioned, that no two detachments are the same. And there's a lot of nuances that goes into how each patient's eye responds to surgery. So I think that it's really important for us to know this. I don't think it will still change my management that much, just because my one of my feared detachments is a post-pneumatic retinopexy detachments. They do horribly. So I rather, invest my time trying to figure out, can we figure out why some of these patients have these changes on their EZ zone? And is there anything we could do intra-op that potentially change this, rather than shift my management in terms of whether I do pneumatic retinopexy or vitreoretinopexy.
And I know Rajiv Mooney and other pneumatic proponents may be listening. I would just make the one addition. And they can do horribly. And I think there's different ways pneumatics are done. I mean, I think if you do the cryo before the gas injection versus a stage where you don't haven't done the laser yet, patient selection, not getting subretinal gas, there's a lot of technique involved that can reduce some of the things. I will say that one of the things I don't like about pneumatics is I don't like taking a patient who I would normally take for a buckle, for example, primary buckle for a pneumatic, because I think in those patients, you end up maybe committing to a vitrectomy. Although people, I'm sure there are people out there who have figured out ways to vent that gas and do a buckle without doing the vitrectomy. That usually kind of tips it towards maybe a patient who, so if I have a patient who would not have needed a vitrectomy, I usually don't like to do a pneumatic. Yoshi, what about, like, so let's say even if you do a vitrectomy, so Safa referenced all these things that can happen in surgery, blood pressure issues and blocks and changes in eye pressure, but we don't necessarily attribute outer retinal changes to those things, although they certainly could be related and we don't know for sure. We usually attribute these outer retinal changes to something to do with subretinal fluid and retinal reattachment. And one of the things that's been argued in favor of pneumatics is this sort of all organic, grass-fed, like your retina is going to reattach itself. So that is more conducive to a better visual outcome. And I say that not to just be flippant, but being joking, but I think there may be some truth to that. I mean, the same reason that buckle patients may have better visual outcomes of vitrectomy patients. Is there something about forcing the retina back into place that is bad? Or is it something to do, is it intra-op or something positioning post-op? Does this make you change like how you approach drainage, for example, for detachment? Do you drain differently? Are you less or more inclined to use PFO or retinotomy versus draining from the break? Maybe leaving some fluid rather than doing a full AFX? Any of these things you think about when you see a paper like this?
No, so many points to discuss here. But to tackle a few of them, I think most studies have shown that PFO doesn't really make a difference. I think, you know, Mooney showed a couple of cases about that also. How you drain the fluid doesn't make much of a difference. Personally, I leave a little bit of pre-retinal fluid because I don't want folds. I do believe in the organic, as you mentioned, grass-fed retinal reattachment techniques, where you rely on the RPE to gently reoppose the retina. You never have folds in after a buckle, for example. You get dimples of fluid. That's a different issue though. But a lot of it also, while I was reading this paper, was how much of it is really significant. And so what the authors here did, they looked at the central 3 millimeters, but also looked at the central 6 millimeters. And when you look at the central 3 millimeters, that's your fovea, that's where it really matters. The numbers, the differences were statistically significant, but they weren't that clinically meaningful. For example, when you look at the EZ, it was 24 versus 20. And when you look at the ELM, 7 versus 6, when you look at only that central 3 millimeters. Maybe it does mean, you know, make a difference, because outer retina, it is something very significant, probably the most important outcome. And I believe in that. I think that's a great thing that the authors are bringing attention to. The other question is about pneumatics. You know, pneumatic retinopexies probably do give you better outcomes, given all other things that are equal, and you can do the pneumatics like they did in this particular prospective study in Canada. And the real world is very different, as we saw in the previous paper. Outcomes are going to be different. Our techniques are different. We're going to different offices every day, potentially in a lot of US practices.
Tons of men who don't position, you know, to their better halves. Yeah,
exactly. Terrible. So I think it's a very complex situation. It's something we should think about more.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing, I think this never goes away, I think, and hopefully it never goes away for any of us, is like, I think retina is like, and maybe all surgery fields are like this, it's like this constant battle between don't lose the forest for the trees, right? Focus on the big picture. Let's get the retina attached. Let's focus on the good things we got out of this in terms of avoiding a really, really terrible outcome or bad result, knowing all those bad results that can happen, for example, multiple reattachments, PVR, hypotony, you know, eyes circling the toilet. And then how balancing that with, hey, we can't just ignore things that potentially could help our patients if they're visually significant, like this. And like you said, Yoshi, a lot of these changes are not in the fovea. they're extrafoveal. So how clinically significant are they? Now, the same group from Pivot has post, they have like this eye questionnaire study we reviewed at some point, which has its own weaknesses as a survey, but patients did report less visual symptoms and things like that on that survey when they did it. And I think this is obvious, it's like the constant battle of like fellows listening, young attending. It's like, how do you like reconcile all the, I feel like we just keep adding check marks in our heads for the things you want to do. Like, okay, I want to reattach this retina, but I don't want to induce a refractive shift, but maybe I don't care about that because Yoshi says the buckle is okay. But also now I have to like factor in, well, maybe I want to go a little slower with the AFX. Maybe that influences a little bit of that easy. Look, we want to be so detail oriented about what we do. And yet I don't know if it's possible for every single one of us to keep all of those things in mind when we're doing surgery. And I don't say that as a cop-out. I think we should strive for that again. That's what I said earlier. But this is, I think, the biggest challenge is like, if this is some sort of real in some instance, but then you also have this fail rate for pneumatic retinopexy that's out there. And obviously we can improve in the technique base, but not everyone's a good pneumatic candidate. Like, how do we reconcile that? Chasing the best outcomes when we know that we're seeing things that we're like, you know, that we've all had patients like that. We're like, everything went great. And you're looking at that outer retina, looking at their vision. You're like, I don't really quite understand why that is. And not beating yourself up about it, but also taking lessons from it for the next patient. I don't know. I guess you can go any tangent on this point or anything from this paper, but I think my overall point is papers like this make me feel humbled. They make me feel stupid a little bit. They make me feel a little sad. And then they also are inspiring, but it's kind of that struggle about like, what is actually like, how do I keep my eye on what's actually important while not forgetting that, yes, I want to try to make these incremental improvements that may have some quality of life measures.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I think that there are the big picture goals when you're looking at a patient who comes into your office with a retinal detachment, and then there are these more nuanced goals. And for me, I think this paper was helpful in that it brought up some of those more nuanced goals and maybe how we can kind of use imaging to help us answer questions about why those things are happening. But you have to balance that, like you said, with, you know, your rate of success, your single surgery success for the patient and getting their retina reattached and getting them visually rehabilitated with, you know, the potential small risk for metamorphopsia or small amount of distortion after surgery. So I think you're right. It's everything sort of a balance and you have to keep that big picture in mind. But I think these studies are really important because they do constantly kind of push us to strive to ask questions about techniques and how we can do better.
On that inspiring note, Yoshi, end with words of inspiration.
You know, when we're... fixing retinal detachments and thinking about the data and listening to people at the podium, there's going to be voices coming from all directions. Like you mentioned, you're going to have Mooney saying pneumatic eye. You're going to have Ed Ryan saying buckle. You're going to have Steve Charles saying vitrectomy. And this is where medicine is really an art, where, you know, you take that into consideration. You do what's comfortable in your hands and what's right for the patient in front of you, because each patient, each eye, each retina is going to be different. And like you alluded to earlier, we do need to strive for that 100%. Every failure still needs to hurt. And otherwise, we're not doing this correctly. And I think regarding the studies out there, all these papers kind of accumulate like little by little. And at certain points, there's like a big shift that happens. And so each paper, I think, does matter. It's about like, when are you going to make that shift? And another thing that, you know, Jay, we struggled with is we were trying to figure out whether I did the protocol AB podcast with you or not. I looked that up also, and we did do that together.
Yeah. Okay. I sounded so. I mean, I'm looking at you, and I'm like, Yoshi, you were definitely there.
Yeah. We did do protocol AB.
Okay. I feel better.
We also did protocol W. I mean, we struggle with together. It because, you know, we're dudes. We're at a disadvantage here.
I'm going to send you a t-shirt for saying I did all these protocols with Sridhar and all I got was this dumb shirt. Okay, guys, thank you. It just went way, way over, but it was a really great podcast. Safa, Avni, Yoshi, thank you so much for joining us and talking about these papers.
Thanks so much.
Jay. Thank you for having us.
As always, you can find this episode and all other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 297 episodes there sorted by category. In addition, you can find a link to subscribe and receive email updates as episodes release. Remember, we are on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can also find us in your podcast store of your favorite mobile device, Android or Apple, and find and subscribe to us there. You can contact us in many ways, social media, email, retinapodcast@gmail.com, or by clicking the Contact Us link on our website. Many thanks to our three correspondents, Avni Finn, Safra Rahmani, and Yoshio Nakawa, for their help and for their insights. Thank you to our whole team here at Retina Podcast. That includes Drs. Angela Chang, Louis Kai, and Mike Vinicasa, who assembled the episode with the production and the social media. Thank you, listeners, for inspiring this podcast, for listening, for taking care of patients, for being the great doctors that you are. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.